Welcome to the Gloria Purvis podcast, where we talk about issues in the Catholic Church and in society that matter to you and to me. And I'm glad you're here to have that conversation with me. My guest today is the Archbishop of San Francisco, Salvatore Cordiglione. The Archbishop has just released a statement restricting the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, from receiving the sacrament of the Eucharist until she repudiates her public support of abortion and goes to the Sacrament of Reconciliation. Speaker Pelosi is a Catholic who represents the Congressional District of San Francisco, and this is where the restriction is limited. It's limited to his Archdiocese of San Francisco. In a statement, the Archbishop laments that Speaker Pelosi's position on abortion has become more extreme over the years. He said that he's made numerous attempts to speak with her to help her understand this grave evil, but all that was to no avail. He states, "I have determined that the point has come in which I must make a public declaration that she is not to be admitted to Holy Communion unless and until she publicly repudiates her support for abortion rights and confesses and receives absolution for her cooperation in this evil in the Sacrament of Penance." And he has accordingly sent her a notification to this effect, which he has now made public. I'm going to speak to Archbishop Cordiglione about his decision, how it came to be, and what consequences it will have on an already polarized political climate in the country and in the Catholic Church. The Gloria Purvis podcast is a production of America Media, where real, honest conversations are happening on the most important issues at the intersection of the church and the world. And that's unique. You may not agree with everything we publish or even everything we talk about on this podcast. And that's okay. That's healthy. We need to listen to each other and be open to different ideas and perspectives. So, if this podcast is meaningful to you, please make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your podcast app and never miss an episode. You can also support it by getting a digital subscription to America. How do you do that? Go to americamagazine.org/subscribe and sign up today. The link is in the show notes. Stick around. My conversation with Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione is up next. Archbishop Cordiglione, thank you so much for coming back to the Gloria Purvis podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, the question with all that's going on right now with Dobbs v. Jackson, with the leaked opinion that Roe perhaps could be overturned, why now? Why make this decision now?
The leaked decision and the Dobbs case really have nothing to do with it. The timing of it. As you mentioned, I've been trying for quite some time to. She did speak with me over the years a couple of times. But more recently, with her advocacy for codifying the Roe decision in federal law, it's becoming more and more extreme and more aggressive. And I've been trying to speak with her about this. I've been debating this within my own conscience for many years, actually. So this is not something that's just come up recently. I've been discerning this. I've consulted with people whom I respect for their intelligence, their integrity, and their pastoral sensitivity, who would have different sort of perspectives on the situation to get their thinking on it. I've done a lot of prayer and fasting, so I've been struggling with this for a long time.
Can you talk a little bit more about the process for informing your conscience and making this decision?
Yes. First of all, one has to be clear about what is right and what is wrong. Okay, so let's be clear about this, that the point of our conscience is not to decide what's right and wrong. Forming our conscience is a process of helping us to figure out what, in principle, what is right and what is wrong. The role of conscience is to help us make the right decision in a specific situation based on what is right and wrong. Informing our conscience, again, it's these three principles: the need to address the injustice, to repair scandal, and to move the person down the path of conversion because of the spiritual harm it causes themselves. So in this sense, I was also following the advice that, Pope Benedict, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger in charge of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, sent a letter to bishops here in the United States back in 2004, when he gave us advice on how to approach this, specifically with politicians, Catholic politicians, and specifically on the two issues of abortion and euthanasia. And he said, we need to meet, dialogue, to try to move them down the path of conversion. And if after several attempts, it comes to the point where it's clear this is not going to happen, then the bishop or the pastor, he says, is to declare that the person is not to be admitted to Holy Communion. So I'm guided by the principles articulated by Pope Francis and taking the approach of the advice that then Cardinal Ratzinger gave us.
So you've reached out to her office privately, and you're pretty confident she's received the messages you've sent her privately. Is there a pastoral reason to make this public, to make the announcement?
If she's not to be admitted to Holy Communion, then our priests and the extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion, all those who are communion ministers, need to know that.
Is this in some way also to prepare for the scandal?
Yes.
The public witness that she's given on this? How does that work in this case?
Scandal is an action that would it lead others into error or into sin. So the scandal here is, again, as I was referring to earlier, that someone who's strongly advocating for something as evil as abortion and taking communion creates confusion among people, and they can begin to think that it's acceptable for a Catholic to believe this. And sometimes people ask me about that. One news reporter in a secular media, not a Catholic media, asked me if is it acceptable for a Catholic to be in favor of the so-called right to abortion. So it wasn't clear in his mind, but it should be clear in everyone's mind. So that's how it leads people into a mistaken idea that this is acceptable, and then can actually lead them into doing the evil or condoning it.
And just for our listeners and our viewers, and we're talking about abortion, we are not talking about when the child has already died in the womb and the mother has to undergo a D&C to remove the remains of her unborn child who's already died. You're talking about the direct, intentional ceasing, taking, killing of the child in the womb. And that's what you're talking about when you're talking about abortion, something that's an elective process.
Yes, yes. And that's what sets this issue. There are many really very critical issues we're facing today. But the difference with abortion, it involves the direct taking of an innocent human life. And as much injustice as there is and challenges we're facing, I don't see any legislators advocating the direct taking of innocent human life on any other issue. So that's what really sets the gravity of this apart.
From any other issue, like things like the death penalty, which people may wonder why not, you know, do something like this on the death penalty or on immigration or on other economic justice issues. You see this as a singular issue in the context of it is unique and apart from those other issues?
Yeah, or even racism, you know.
Even racism.
Didn't mean that now, but I mean, we're horrified when we look back 60, 70 years ago that there was a time when lynchings were acceptable in some parts of the country, among some people. That's just horrifying to us. But it's the same thing, right? It's the killing of innocent human life. No one would tolerate that nowadays. So I'm trying to see, those of us who understand are trying to open the eyes of our people that this is the direct taking of an innocent human life. And what we envision is a society in which that is unacceptable and no one would ever dream of doing it.
Well, Nancy Pelosi has said that she's a devout Catholic and it is her faith is important to her, an important part of her life. How do you see that statement where she says she's a devout Catholic and she's an open supporter of abortion rights? How does that play in your assessment of her faith? Is she still Catholic?
I cannot judge her conscience. I cannot judge her faith. From my interactions with her, I think she's sincere when she says that. I think her faith really is important to her. It really is important to her to be Catholic, and she feels devotion in her heart. Which makes me perplexed at why she would be so forceful on this issue. As a politician, you know, it's very tricky as a politician. There are so many issues to balance out and trying to come to some kind of consensus and compromise and all that. But to be so aggressively promoting it, and that's not what a devout Catholic does. So I believe in her heart she feels that way, but there is a disconnect on this issue.
Is that one of the reasons why you started your Rose and Rosary for Nancy Pelosi, this campaign you started last year for her?
Yes. I want to help her to understand that this is unacceptable, to kill babies in the womb, and the harm so often it does to women. I mean, those of us in pastoral ministry, we encounter women who have gone through this experience, and we understand how so often they feel alone, afraid, abandoned. They know when they can talk to about it, and they really need support and love to help make a happy decision, a decision for life. So the Rose and Rosary campaign was to help sensitize. It seems to me she has a very maternal heart. She loves speaking about her five children, right? So to sensitize her to that, and also to convey that I know people will accuse me of being political, but this is not political law. It's pastoral.
So that I'm is
not a candidate or against any candidate. It's a pastoral action.
So this is where, but one of the things that she has to do is she has to publicly repudiate her support for abortion rights. And some would say, how could she do that and it not be seen as political, like the very action she has to do to come back, to be able to come back to receive the Eucharist, requires her to make a public repudiation of her support for abortion rights.
I'm very saddened at how this has polarized the country. Of course, we know abortion can never be justified because it's the direct taking of an innocent human life. However, there are ways we can come to a consensus on how the law can work under the present circumstances, because our vision is not making abortion illegal. That would be a big help toward the end. The end is to make abortion unthinkable. But if I often say that the problem is not that women have choice. Too many women don't have choice. Their only choice is abortion. So the answer is, well, what Texas did, right? The Alternatives to Abortion program, provide women with the resources they need to be able to give birth to her child. And then there are other options. She can raise the child herself. She can put the child up for adoption. There's also the old-fashioned solution of marriage, which is not to be always excluded. Sometimes the man does take responsibility, but we need to provide her all of this support. And if she's in a situation where it's, let's say, a college student, you know, a college student should be afforded support so she can carry the child to term and continue her education. And then if she chooses to put the child up for adoption, be supported in that. If she wants to raise the child herself, then be provided the support she needs. I don't know, do colleges have diaper changing systems, for example?
Well, there are many groups trying to work to get colleges to be more hospitable to pregnant and parenting students. So, but that does make me want to ask the question, what policy do you have in your own archdiocese for, you know, your own employees that may get pregnant? And what are the policies like that? Do you have maternity leave policies?
Oh, yeah. We have family leave policies for parenting employees. Yeah, okay. We have a generous family leave policy.
So you mentioned that this decision was a pastoral one, not a political one. And we know it still is going to be interpreted by many people as a political one. What would you say, though, to people who treat this public instruction for Pelosi to refrain from communion as, you know, a victory, like, yes, finally, a victory to be celebrated, and see it as the church exercising its power in the temporal order in a way that makes them celebrate? What would you say to them?
I know there will probably be some people thinking that, but it's a sad moment, really. And I would just encourage them to see this in a bigger light. It's sad that this kind of action would have to be taken, and we need to resort to more prayer and fasting.
We'll be right back. You did say that you consulted with people. How do you think your brother bishops are going to receive this notification, this public statement?
I suppose there'll be a variety of opinions, but I think as bishops, we respect each other's decisions in matters like this. Each bishop has to decide in accordance with his conscience, and these and other types of situations as well. And they're usually very complex. There are a number of different values and priorities to weigh, and taking an action or not taking an action. What good will it do? What evil will it avoid? What might be the side effects? All these things have to be weighed. And we can come to different prudential judgments, again, using our conscience. The conscience is not to decide what's right and wrong. We all agree on what's right and wrong. That's not in question. The question is how pastorally to respond to these complex situations. And I think we all pretty much respect each other in making our decisions, because we're all struggling to form our conscience as well and discern the right thing to do.
So you're not saying that they all have to necessarily follow your path? Because, of course, people are going to say, well, what other Catholic politicians perhaps are making the same kind of statements as Nancy Pelosi? And, of course, President Biden comes to mind. And have you spoken with Cardinal Gregory at all about this?
I've had conversations with him about the issue. Okay. Yes.
Okay. So you've already spoken. Are any other bishops? You're like the first bishop that I can think of to make a statement like this, other than in most recent memory, I'm thinking of Archbishop Brummel of New Orleans, who actually went a step further and excommunicated people for interfering in his authority as a bishop in New Orleans to desegregate. Why not excommunication here?
Well, first of all, I'm actually not the first bishop to do this. I recall I was a new bishop back in early 2000s when then Bishop Burke of La Crosse, right before he moved to St. Louis, issued such a notification with regard to Catholic legislators in his diocese. Also, the then Father Van, who's now Bishop Van of Orange, he was the pastor in a parish in Springfield, Illinois. That was the parish of Dick Durbin, who spoke with him and advised him he should not be receiving communion. The bishop of the diocese at that time, then Bishop Lucas, now Archbishop Lucas of Omaha, backed him up. The current bishop there, Bishop Tom Papracki, has reaffirmed that. Also, our Archbishop Joseph Nauman of Kansas City in Kansas took this action with regard to Kathleen Sebelius, who was the governor of Kansas at the time. So other bishops have taken this action. But we excommunication is has a whole nother set of circumstances of considerations. It's more severe. I don't want to take a more severe tack if I don't have to. I'd rather do what's the minimum I need to do in order to repair the scandal.
So let's make sure everybody understands. She can attend Mass. She just may not present herself to receive the Eucharist until she repudiates her public support and receives the sacrament of reconciliation.
Yes.
Was there any other option for her? Any other way she could correct this and be able to come back to the Eucharist?
I issued a pastoral letter a year ago on this topic about proper disposition to receive Holy Communion, cooperation in evil, and specifically on the abortion question. It's Catholic 101 that we're supposed to be free of any serious sin in order to be properly disposed to receive Holy Communion. If we are guilty of serious sin, we have the great grace of the sacrament of penance, so we can go to confession, avail ourselves of that sacrament, receive God's forgiveness in the sacrament to be restored to a right disposition. That involves contrition, right? A firm purpose of amendment, that we repent of the wrong that we've done and are sincere in avoiding that in the future. So cooperation, it's not just one who performs an abortion or is an accomplice to it, but the actively promoting it is a cooperation in the evil that puts one in that situation. So again, as it would have to involve repentance, right? Repenting of this evil, but also politicians, as I was saying earlier, they have to find ways where they can come to some kind of compromise or better yet consensus on policies that everyone can live with. And I do believe there are ways to do that. And I think then Cardinal Ratzinger also spoke about this in a document on Catholics and Political Life, that a politician can vote for a piece of legislation that would keep abortion legal if it has the effect of reducing it. That would not be implicate them in a cooperation with the evil. So, for example, a parental notification law, just as an example, keep abortion legal. The minor girl can have the abortion, but the parents have to be notified, or the parents consent. The parents have to give consent. That's an example of a piece of legislation that a politician can vote for that does not implicate them in the evil of the abortion.
So help us understand. I know people often bring up Canon 915. And one of the things that is to note about Canon 915 is that's in the section on sacraments. It's not in the penal section of canon Correct. Law. Why are you referencing that section instead of the penal section when many people are going to see this as more of a punishment? So why reference this section instead of the actual penal section?
To underscore that this is not a canonical penalty. It's a declaration of what the situation is in accordance with the protecting the integrity of the sacrament.
I mean, you quote Pope Francis quite a bit in your public statement that our defense of the unborn, he says, must be clear, firm, and passionate. And the Pope has also said that the Eucharist is not a prize for the perfect, but is nourishment for the weak. How does that come to play in this decision to tell Nancy Pelosi, you know, until you don't come to communion? How do you balance that? Or how does this figure into this decision?
Well, what Pope Francis says there doesn't negate what I refer to as Catholic 101 about proper disposition to receive Holy Communion. It does acknowledge that we are, in a sense, we are all unworthy. Right. And we are weak. We have a weakened human nature. And when we're properly disposed to receive Holy Communion, we can avail ourselves of the grace the sacrament gives us to grow stronger. It's kind of like exercising the spiritual muscle. But the idea that we're, in a sense, we're all unworthy, we pray that every time we have Mass, right? As Catholics, right before receiving communion, we use the words of the Roman centurion when our Lord offered to go to his house. He said, "Lord, I am not worthy to receive you." And other rites of the church have the same thing, a confession of unworthiness. So there is this sense in which we're all unworthy. And that's doesn't contradict the idea of also being properly disposed.
So what do you think that this telegraphs to so many other Catholics who may have the same attitude, disposition, and beliefs around abortion rights as Nancy Pelosi?
I hope it will have the effect of a clearly teaching on the issue. I would imagine some people are going to see this as being very heavy-handed, and I'm kind of being an ogre here, but I really would prefer not to do this, but I cannot in my conscience allow the situation to continue and cause this scandal. And people are getting confused, people are getting upset, and it's also fueling these flames of polarization and dissension. Some people might accuse me of doing that as well, but I just know in my conscience I have to do something to teach clearly about this evil, and that there are solutions to this dilemma that we're in.
You think that this singles out Nancy Pelosi in a position Does that square with, you think, with Pope Francis has talked about the Catholics must recognize the equally sacred, however, the lives of the poor, those already born, the destitute, the abandoned, and the underprivileged, and so on? Do you feel like this singles her out and singles out abortion in a way that's apart from what Pope Francis has said?
Not apart from what Pope Francis has said, it singles out abortion as the issue. I mean, I admire Speaker Pelosi for her advocacy for the poor. I mean, we're all together on that. But I was speaking earlier about how abortion is different because it involves the direct taking of an innocent. Well, if we think about since the Roe decision 50 years ago, it's over 60 million babies murdered in their mother's wombs. I mean, can we really grasp the depth of that evil? 60 million babies murdered in their mother's wombs. This is something apart. These other issues are very serious. Some are the evils we're dealing with there, but this just sets it apart.
So then, you know, I hear that and I keep thinking, but and you say you don't want to excommunicate, but then maybe help people understand what is the difference here between what this is versus an excommunication?
An excommunication involves, it intends more people who have an office in the church because it's a deprivation of other kind of rights and privileges of exercising jurisdiction, having any role in a liturgical service, of titles and honors and things like that. So it would be more, I mean, it couldn't be anyone who's Catholic, but kind of the deprivations that an excommunication involves affects more people who have some kind of an office or position in the church.
So as it is now, she can attend Mass, she cannot receive the Eucharist. If she were to die tomorrow, she could still have a Catholic funeral Mass?
Yes.
She could, okay. I think, as I think about this, the Eucharist is a source and summit of our faith, and being told that you need to repudiate what you've said publicly and you need to come to the sacrament of confession. How do you know when she's done this? Obviously, we all know she publicly repudiates, but in terms of the sacrament of reconciliation, go to any priest, or is it that she needs to come to you to confess?
Well, she could go to any priest. I would presume that she makes a public repudiation. I would presume that she will have done that.
Okay.
I'm not going to go checking around. You know,
there's been, you know, I think about the history of this country and a lot of fear of Catholics actually being ruled by Rome in terms of politicians and things like that. How would you, for people who maybe don't understand the faith, how would you help them see that this isn't that the Pope or Bishop is actually ruling or making political decisions in place of their elected politicians?
This really, well, there are many great human rights issues of our time, but abortion is really paramount. So we can compare it to other periods of history and what the great human rights issue was, whether it was slavery in the mid 19th century or civil rights in the mid 20th century. They were faith leaders who led those efforts. You know, it was faith leaders, well, of course, Dr. Martin Luther King, but other leaders of faith who joined with him to advocate for civil rights in the Jim Crow South. Were they being political? Were they delving too much into politics, or they just stayed in their churches, or were they living out their faith and advocating for what is just and true for people who are being oppressed? Isn't that part of our role as faith leaders?
Well, I think that's one of the things that people would like us to not think, that we have a role in the public square when we're motivated by our faith. But yeah, the civil rights movement had very much a Christian ethos. There's no doubt about that. If you study the movement, you study the writings of Dr. King, I think perhaps in this country, the notion of participation in the public square may be too narrow. And people will say things like separation of church and state, thinking that means that people who are of faith are not to act on their faith in the public square. And I imagine that you and I both, and many, many other Catholics, including our church, would say that's an incorrect understanding.
We need to make a distinction between basic values of what's right and wrong and what is a faith-specific doctrine, right? So to say, thou shalt not steal is a universal principle, and we have laws that punish people who steal, right? And thou shalt not lie. so these are basic rules of right and wrong. That's not imposing our religion on others. Imposing our religion on others would be something like requiring people to attend church on Sunday, right? That's a religious doctrine, or to hold certain beliefs. So I want to be clear about that.
You know, when you talked about abortion, you talked about ministering to women, you talked about the horror of abortion. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what has been your experience in dealing with women who maybe were considering abortion or have had abortions? Maybe some have come and confessed to you. Can you share a little bit about that?
I'm very proud of my own church that offers these healing experiences for women and for men as well. Often men are scarred by the experience. So we have the Project Rachel that helps to heal people who have this experience and to help help provide resources for women who are in crisis pregnancies. I've heard women say, this is why I say the problem is they don't have choice. I've heard women say that I didn't want to go through with it, but I felt like I had no choice. And I hear after they go through with it, they can't talk about it. You know, they're shamed into silence. They're not supposed to feel guilty about it. So then this sense of isolation then begins to worsen. So the need for these sort of healing experiences. I've known of women who turn it into something positive. They become pro-life advocates, and they're with their experience, they can be very compelling witnesses to the sanctity of life. I've heard from women who had kind of were changing their mind when they were being led into the clinic, and they were lied to, you know, told it's just a clump of cells.
So in your formation in seminary and preparing you for become a priest, did they talk about these kinds of things, how to minister to women in these situations? Or was it just something once you were ordained and being a priest that you had these encounters? I mean, I'm just wondering what kind of experience and encounters you've had in addition to understanding the teachings of the church that have softened your heart to see this as really something that's damaging to women.
Well, I was ordained a priest in 1982, so I was in the seminary in the mid to late 70s, early 80s, and this was just emerging, right? And so I don't think seminaries had really begun to think through how to minister to women in that situation. But in the first parish that I was assigned to, there was an abortion clinic in the parish, so I would join with parishioners who would gather in front of there to pray on Saturdays, because to me, it's always been obvious that's a little baby inside of the mother. And a little later on, when I got to know more people involved in pro-life advocacy and women who've gone through the experience, I began to understand more how it affects the mother. And later on, when I work with people who are trying to bring people affected in these healing experiences, how much it affects others in her network of relationships. It's not just the mother, the child who's affected. It's, you know, her parents, her siblings, her other children, sometimes the father of the child, if you wants the child to be born. So her friends. So there's a whole network of relationships that's affected by it. So the more I've been kind of involved in advocating for life and getting to know others who do this, the more my eyes have been opened to the wider reality of this.
And so it seems like to me, you've come over time to, through experience, come to maybe even more fully understand what the Holy Father's talked about, the interconnectedness of the issue of the matter. You see how it affects more than just the child in the womb and the woman, how it affects the whole community. And I'm trying to think, is there any other issue that has that kind of interconnectedness, or maybe any other issue or situation where you think you would have to make, or you think you'd make this kind of decision that someone, until they repudiate what they've said publicly and done publicly, needs to not present themselves for communion?
It'd be hard for me to say at this point.
So if people want to, well, are you still having your Rose and Rosary for Nancy campaign, given that this public statement, are you still doing that?
We're still doing that. We'll send rosaries now. People can sign up for that at BenedictsInstitute.org if they want to participate, and we'll send her a rosary.
So you still have a lot of hope. You still have a lot of hope for Nancy Pelosi to come to repudiate this. You still have a lot of hope there?
As I said, I can't judge her conscience, but I do believe she's sincere when she says she's devout. And she speaks so fondly of her five children. I have to believe there's hope, yes.
And you've said that when you've interacted with her, it's been pleasant. You've had, she's been a pleasant person you've interacted with. So to me, that says there has to be a way that we can constructively dialogue on these issues, especially within the church. Do you have any tips on how we might be able to do that?
Try not to judge others. Try to have a human interaction, to try to see the other as a fellow brother or sister in our human family and get to know them personally. It helps to put things in a different perspective. I am grateful to the speaker, who's always been respectful to me in public and in private. So I think that's a good example of how we can talk about these issues without being so divisive. But we do need to talk. And this, to be frank, it has been a frustration that I haven't been able to speak with her.
Is there anything you haven't said that you'd like to say now before we wrap the interview? Is there anything you want to say directly to Nancy Pelosi, maybe even?
Well, what I've said before, she has a wonderful maternal heart, and she's a great advocate for the poor. Women in these crisis pregnancy situations need a lot of advocacy. So to see that, and we await her with open arms.
I don't sense a lot of animosity here from you toward her at all. And that's one thing I'm very much taking away from this. You don't have any animosity toward her. You seem very hopeful that she will respond positively, affirmatively to this. I imagine you see this as an invitation to her, not a punishment, but she respond in that way. And I think it could be difficult with all the outer voices, all the other voices in our society, going to weigh in on this and going to position it as something negative and punitive. Do you still have open channels to her to be able to talk to you privately if she chooses to?
I've let her know I'm ready and willing to speak if ever, whenever, wherever, and however she wishes. The channels of communication are still open. And no, I don't have animosity. It's something I really would rather not do. And I know I'm going to be judged harshly. I know I'm going to be accused of being punitive, of being political. That's all false. But my conscience won't allow me to refrain from doing this. I cannot be at peace of conscience without doing so.
One last thing, since you've mentioned your conscience, you've made some clarifications about conscience. I know there are going to be people asking, but what about Nancy Pelosi's conscience? How would you respond to that?
Well, on this issue, she needs to better form her conscience.
And you're willing to help her do that?
I mean, we don't say that with other issues, right? We didn't say that with slavery. What about in my conscience, it's legitimate to own slaves? Do we allow that to continue? What if in my conscience, it's separate but equal is a good thing? Do we allow that to continue? We don't do that with other issues that are objectively wrong. So instead, we need to help people open people's eyes to the evil. We would never go back to allowing Jim Crow laws now because we realize how evil it is. A lot of people back then didn't.
And so you're willing to help her in that regard, or at least try to by what you're doing here to get her attention and let her see that it's grave matter, that this is what we understand and believe as Catholics, and come back. Is that what your whole intention is here?
And there are, as I said before, there are political solutions, or policy, I should say, policy solutions to the dilemma that we're in.
Thank you, Archbishop Corleone, so much for joining us on the Gloria Purvis Podcast and America Media.
You're welcome. Thank you again for having me.
I'm so glad you're tuning into the Gloria Purvis podcast and journeying with me through these important and sometimes challenging conversations. For more on this story regarding Archbishop Corleone's statement, visit americamagazine.org. And please share this episode with a friend or family member. Be sure to subscribe to the Gloria Purvis podcast on your podcast app. Leave us a review if you can. I would love to hear from you. And by the way, you can follow me on Twitter at Gloria_Purvis and on Instagram at I am Gloria Purvis. The Gloria Purvis podcast is a production of America Media. This episode is produced by Sebastian Gomes and Maggie Van Dorn and engineered by Frank Tucson. You can learn more about America Media at americamagazine.org. We'll see you next time.